Hey, Misty. So this is the deal. Either you are gonna let me go right fucking now, or I'm gonna wring your little boyfriend's neck. Swear to you, I'll fucking do it.
Fine. Go ahead. I'll just get another one.
Fine. I will.
Everybody, welcome to our podcast. I'm Wendy.
And I'm Daphne.
And I'm Enwin.
And this is Yellow Jackets WTF. This is our 14th episode of the podcast.
This episode, we're covering Yellow Jackets Season 1, Episode 8, Flight of the Bumblebee.
I'm so excited that Enwin is here from the land of paradise.
Yes.
So great to be here. I have been, as you know from all my feedback, I have been listening to WTF the whole way through, and I did jump on the Yellow Jackets bandwagon a little late, but it was in perfect timing to catch up with the first five and then the next three. And oh, I am just absolutely loving this rewatch and getting to see everything with the perspective of having seen the whole season. So it's fantastic to be here. Thank you.
That is great. I don't think we've ever podcasted before, so I'm really excited. I always love everything you were on. I listened to your, was it the Zedhead show? Where you talked about Lord of the Rings?
Uh-huh.
That was really great. That was a great one. And I'm not even a huge fan of Lord of the Rings, but I still loved every part of it.
Oh, that's so cool. Look, that experience was so much fun that I think even if you're not into Lord of the Rings, just the little stories that come up when you have an experience like that hopefully are palatable to everyone. So I'm glad you enjoyed it.
Yeah. So if you want to hear Anwen's Lord of the Rings story, you have to subscribe to Patreon for Podcastica and you will have access to all the Zedhead shows and you can hear Anwen tell her behind the scenes stories about Lord of the Rings.
Yes. And Wendy, you and I did a... I think it was called Listener Chit Chat. Mm-hmm. Before that, we did one of those, and I did one with Jason. One, I think it was episode 2 of the Zedhead show. It was a lot of fun.
Yep,
it's cool to get that insight into different things.
It really is. I really enjoy them, and they're always something obscure, which is always really interesting to hear about. So let's go ahead and get started with our fucked up moment of the week. Anwin, you're our guest. Would you like to go first?
Sure, absolutely. Look, there were so many to choose from this week. and it was such an action-packed episode. There's just so much and, yeah, quite a lot of gruesome things, as always. But the one that I actually had a really visceral reaction to was Laura Lee hitting the bottom of the pool and just that dull underwater thud. And then the blood spurting out into the water was so realistic and so hideous. It was almost worse the second time because you know it's coming. And, oh, it was just so gross and so well done. I thought it was fantastic.
I must have been warned as a child. I've always had a fear of diving in a shallow pool, breaking my neck. So that's immediately what I first thought of when I saw it.
Oh, it's gross.
Yeah.
When I was little, I jumped into the shallow end and didn't realize it was so shallow, but I was just jumping in. I banged my knees on the bottom. It was not good. Not good. Cement. Yeah, no. Not fun.
How about you, Daph?
Oh, my goodness. This one, as Anwin just said, was really hard to pick one. I think I'm going to have to go, though, with... They presumed that Van was already dead, so they put her on a fire. The problem is she wasn't dead. And it's like, why didn't you check her pulse? I know you guys were upset and you were freaking out. You probably thought she was dead. Check her pulse. See if she's breathing. Don't just put her on a funeral pyre. I mean,
where was Dr. Misty Quigley when we needed her?
She was there.
I know.
I wondered that too. And I thought, would they not have even noticed that she wasn't cold? But then I guess if it was cold outside, maybe her skin was cold anyway. And if her pulse might not have been that strong, it could have been really thready if she was sort of, you know, pretty weak and things. But surely there'd be some bubbling breath coming out through that sort of hole in the side of her face.
Or maybe wait a hot minute and figure out what you're going to do before you decide to set a pyre.
It made for great TV though, right?
Yes.
It did. I just feel like they went straight to the fire. It happened, and 10 minutes later, they were doing a fire.
Yeah.
Seemed very quick.
Maybe they were worried about the smell of blood drawing some more wolves or something. I don't know. We don't see that part of the conversation, I guess.
They didn't share that with us, unfortunately.
Usually, I come up with a runner-up, but this one, I'm going to use the same one because it really got me. I just feel like Van's having a really bad time.
Yes.
You know, plane crashes, she's almost burned to death in the wreckage, she's starving, mauled by wolves, and then her friends set her on fire. That's a bad time.
She even said it. Really? A fire? She must be thinking this is all just a joke. Like, everything you just said, Wendy, she's been through.
Yeah.
It seems like too much.
I really liked that she kind of... her personality was still there when she said that. She was exactly. Like still being a little sarcastic.
Yeah.
Yeah. Classic Van. I love her. She's one of my favorite characters. I think she isn't afraid to speak up, and she has such a great way of being sassy and just putting it all out there for everybody. And I really like that, like, honesty about her.
She's also aggressive, and she's mostly been on the right side of things throughout all this, but she's also pretty aggressive about what she believes in. And I'm really curious to see where that takes us in season two.
Absolutely. Especially when you see that final shot of her, you know, absolutely flanking Lottie there as one of her lieutenants almost. it will be really interesting to see how much into that cult she gets and what her role is going to be.
And she really gave Thaisa almost an ultimatum. Like, if you're not with me in everything, then we're not going to be together.
Yeah.
And so she holds a lot of power in her hands.
Yeah. Yeah, they're now, you know, as we saw at the end, there are three members of Lottie's Church of the Tree Stump. And we'll see what happens next.
Oh, wait.
I did have a couple of runners up for that this week. One is Misty snorting all of Natalie's coke so that she won't do it. And then saying, oh, it burns. Is that normal? Like, you don't even know what that is. For all you know, she could have been sold, you know, bathtub cleaner. I mean, exactly. you don't know. And then the other one, of course, is Laurelie's plane exploding, because that was such a big deal. And honestly, I think it changes the trajectory for Lottie.
Definitely.
All right. We can start with our points. Anwen?
All right. So my first point, continuing on, is Laurelie, since we're on the same theme. You know, this is really a big episode for her. And I really liked watching it the second time to actually see all the tiny little details with Laurelie, because up until now, because she's not one of the characters who we see as an adult, there's maybe less focus on her when we see her in the woods. She's not really, she's, you know, pivotal, but she's not really a full side character. So it's kind of interesting to be able to see what she does in this episode. And starting with the flashback to when she's by the pool, which we already talked about, that horrendous thud when she hits the bottom. But when she's sitting there on the side before she goes in, did you notice she has this quite a sunburst kind of theme throughout this? She actually had really beautiful, subtle sunburst nail polish on her feet. So her little toes had beautiful little nail polish with wee white sort of sunburst design. And then behind her, there's also a sunburst poster in the background. When she's been revived by the lifeguard, we see a burst of sunlight reflecting off the lifeguard's cross. And so there's this real theme there for her of light and sunlight. And I think it represents her religious side, but also maybe sort of the pure side of her nature as well. And in the episode, we see that, you know, her big moment in there, of course, is announcing that she's going to take the plane. And she's so determined. She's such a focused type of person. But I like how you can see her resolve building all episode. I think her resolve has started to build before this episode, but really subtle ways. If you go back, you can kind of see and go, oh, yeah, I think she's starting to think through things and decide that something needs to happen. But when this episode, you can see her resolve is building all the way through as she sees things deteriorating around the camp and around, you know, what they're all going to be doing. And then there's a moment when the girls bring Van back and their mission to go and find rescue has failed, that you can just see her decide. She just, that's it, I'm doing this thing. And she says that fantastic line, there is no safe anymore. If I don't do this, we're all going to fucking starve. And again, that's one of those instances where the swearing is really impactful because it's rare. You know, round the campfire scene, she did swear, which was hilarious in one of those early scenes. But it's sort of like when they're allowed to drop that really rare F-bomb in The Walking Dead. When she says it, it's like, ooh, she swore. And then everyone in the room as well, you can tell, especially Coach Ben, it's like, whoa, she's serious. And he tries to talk her out of it. She won't be talked out of it. And that's when that sort of power sort of switches, I think, where Coach Ben, he might have been under this impression that he's the adult. And so he's kind of, you know, overseeing things or running things. And I think that's the moment also in his face where he realizes he's lost that. And then when the plane takes off, there's this amazing sense of hope and excitement. And I think even Coach Ben hadn't wanted her to go. He looks quite amazed. He looks a little bit hopeful even. And then, of course, the plane explodes and their heartbreak is just palpable. And like you were saying as well, Daphne, I think that's the moment when it just gets really dark for all of them. So their two attempts to leave have failed spectacularly. One person being really badly injured and the other person being dead. And you sort of can't deny that symbolism as well. I think of Laura Lee, she's the most pure and innocent of them all. And she's gone. And that marks the end of their innocence and the beginning of their descent into that wildness. And that all happens, of course, in the next episode. Now that we know and we're looking back in retrospect, we can see the descent into wildness starts now and then continues through to the next episode. That's when things really get out of control with their wild party and mushroom taking.
Yeah, I felt the same. I actually wrote things down. One of my notes is, here is when the girls start to take charge. And that was when Laura Lee says to Ben, what are you going to do to stop me? And again, I mean, I feel like Laura Lee was the moral compass. They teased her. They didn't exactly treat her super well, I think. They looked at her religion as kind of something that they could poke fun at. And for her to drop an F-bomb, I think any of the other girls could have dropped it and it would have been overlooked. But because she is so pure of heart and she is so good, that really got their attention. And, you know, she's going to do it. And she also tried to get their attention. And then she's banging this ladle on the table because they're not paying attention to her. She's not, at that point, I feel like she became a different Laura Lee, a stronger Laura Lee, and realizing that, well, it didn't work any other way. I guess I'm going to have to do this myself. And rewatching that, all I can think is there was a passenger seat on that plane, and I'm grateful that neither Van nor Shauna were on it with her.
Mm-hmm. And it also makes you think, with that new strengthening of her character if she hadn't died in that plane explosion and she had been there for the next steps of what we've seen already and then what's going to happen in the next few seasons. How would the path of all of them have changed if she had remained there, especially as she was that sort of guiding? It was almost like her her kind of inspiration or that little kind of push that she gave Lottie at the start to go down the path that she's gone in terms of feeling that she's magical or blessed or whatever it is she's feeling. It was almost like this dangerous little spark, but then she wasn't there to control the fire that happens later. So it makes it even more heartbreaking that she's gone. And I feel like it really accelerated what is going to happen to the rest of the girls.
She would have been there to say, "No, Lottie, I didn't mean we were going to worship bear hearts.
Or eat people."
No.
Right.
That's not God's work.
No.
But her death almost makes her a martyr. And so her faith and her spirituality has a much heavier presence after she dies than before. Before, it was almost like a joke. And because she dies, I think, yes, it turns into something else. It turns into whatever they need it to be at the moment. But it has this much heavier presence after she dies, which is sad, but that's kind of what happens. We see that happen.
Absolutely. With people.
Yeah. Okay, Daphne, how about your next point?
I'm trying to decide which one to bring to the table first, because I have a few. But I think I'm going to go with what I think is my biggest one. And I want to talk a little bit about Thaisa and her alluding to Shauna, who obviously understands because she was there, that she's afraid she's going to hurt Simone. So it makes me wonder, is it what happened to Van that she's referring to? Or did something much worse happen after that because of her sleepwalking? We've only seen the beginning pieces of the sleepwalking. We don't know how much more serious it's going to get, but I'm guessing it does get more serious because she's pushing her wife and son out of the house. So I'm wondering, did something even worse happen to Van or someone else because of Thaisa not having control over what she's doing when she goes into these sleepwalking episodes?
My notes, Daphne, almost word for word, that when she says, "I don't know how bad it will get this time, but you know how bad it can get." Does she mean was it when Van was bitten? I think there must be something else, partly timing wise. Van's bit pretty early on in the session, and the time that they were there, they're there for 17 months or 19 months or whatever it was. So we're only talking a couple of months in. She survives that and we see it enough to heal, to know that she is probably not going to die of infection from that wound. So I do feel there's something else, because she also tells Simone later that when the sleepwalking stopped after they were rescued. So that makes me think it probably continued for the time that they were out there, for all of those 17 to 19 months. Something else major has got to happen in the woods that we haven't seen yet. I think you're absolutely right.
We have another 12 months of her sleepwalking.
Yeah, and so far we've seen this incident related to the wolves. We also have Lottie seeing her digging dirt. I'm starting to believe that was Lottie seeing her digging dirt.
Mm-hmm.
Like, I don't think, you know, in eating dirt, I don't think it was just a hallucination. I think she actually saw her doing that. I think that was the beginning of the sleepwalking.
Absolutely. And it's sort of confirmed when she's in the lake with Van, and Van notices the dirt under her fingernails. It's, that by itself, if we hadn't had the other scene, would have just been, oh, they're feral. They're just in the wilderness. There's no mm-hmm. nail brushes and soap. But that paired with the fact that that Lottie actually saw her, I think it confirms it.
Yeah. And I don't think they trust what Lottie sees at this point. I think they still look at her differently than what we know Van and Misty do by the end of this season. I think they still look at Lottie like she's just a little bit crazy. Like, they don't. Laura Lee was the one who kind of looked at Lottie like she could be something bigger than she is. And instead, now, Lottie is left with these girls that don't necessarily support her. But at least at the end of the season, we see her with Van and Misty. The problem is, that also makes me think of the angel and the devil on your shoulder. Because she's got Van on one side, who I do trust and think would try to do the good for people. And Misty on the other side, who I wouldn't venture a guess what she's going to do. If those are her advisors, that makes me a little bit nervous. Because I mean, it's very unpredictable on the Misty side.
Always.
I did write down one of my notes was that Thaisa says, when she's talking to Shauna, she says, or no, I think she was talking to Simone. I'm not sure now. But she says, it fucking scares me because the last time I, and then she kind of stops there. It was Simone, I'm pretty sure. And after a bit, she says that she may have let Biscuit out of the house, but she was going to say something else.
Yeah.
And I'm not sure what. Maybe, you know.
Maybe she was going to admit what happened. Maybe yeah. She was going to tell Simone, and then she just realized that whatever it is, is just so terrible that she has to hold on to it. She can't. She doesn't want Simone to see her differently. But then she's also pushing her away and changing their relationship forever. I don't know that they can come back from this. Especially because we know what Simone found in the basement. No matter who put it there, Simone will always probably wonder if it was Thaisa.
And it seems like her relationship, they're obviously very close, they love each other, and there'll be quite a deep understanding from Simone about what did happen to her in the woods, but she won't know every detail. It wouldn't have been Ty's nature to have told her that every single detail. I think that she probably was about to in that moment because she felt like she wanted to share it to be understood, but then she held back. Like you say, she just, that was too much. That's her facade coming back up again to protect herself.
She also said something earlier when she was having this conversation with Shauna. They were basically talking about sex and about making your, you know, feeling, quote, it. And she admitted that Simone doesn't make her feel it. But she also says that it hasn't gone well for her when she has been with people that make her feel it. So that just makes me wonder who she's referring to when she says that.
I kind of thought she was referring to Van.
Yeah, that's what I'm thinking too.
Like maybe she hasn't ever felt that way again.
Very well could be. You know what? It very well could be.
Especially if she lost her in some way. We don't know what the future of their relationship is. We know they're not together.
Yeah, that's all we know.
But that's all we know, right.
Yeah, it's hard. It's hard to say. And rewatching, like Anwen said earlier, I'm seeing all these details that I missed the first time through. Or in some cases, the second time through. Because after you've seen something, you only remember what you've seen and what you think you've seen in the episode. But then when you see it again, it's like a kick to the head, like, hello, you missed this the first time around.
And this show is peppered with moments like that, isn't it? And
yeah.
In fact, even I think it's going to be one of those ones where every season we're going to have to go back and watch each previous season, because I feel like you get so attuned to noticing the little snippets that mean something now that you even look at the little snippets that you don't know what they mean yet, but you know they're probably meaningful. And so it makes you hyper aware. You kind of think, wow, what's that going to reveal about what happens later? So yeah. It's one of those exciting shows that we're just going to get to watch over and over and over.
Yeah.
For my first point, I'm going to talk about a scene that they showed. They played the song Fade Into You by Mazzy Star. Is that right, Mazzy?
Yes. Mazzy?
And I love the song. And I know I've heard it before, but I just put it on all my playlists now. I just love it. And we see young and grown up Natalie interspersed while this song is playing. And I really like the scene, especially of grown-up Natalie. I know Juliette Lewis is not the typical Hollywood actress, and I think she just did this so well. It's a really raw scene. We don't typically see these kind of scenes in TV shows. Natalie's drinking whiskey out of the bottle. She's just kind of writhing on her bed. It's obvious that she is, you know, it's the weird stuff that we do when no one's watching. And they don't usually put this in shows. And I just really liked that piece of it. It seems to be a portrayal of Natalie's pain and her grief and her addiction, which she's using to mask her pain and her grief. And she's just really good. I liked this scene so much. I've loved Juliette Lewis's portrayal of grown-up Natalie, and I can't imagine anybody else playing that role now.
Definitely not.
And I know the actress has talked about how it's been so difficult for her to play this role, and I just hope she sticks in there.
I wrote this note down, too, because I like the transition. Where it went from young Natalie, I think she was walking out a door, into the Natalie that we see in her hotel room. And so I did look into the song. Fade Into You was released in 1993. So it would have been released at a time that young Natalie would have heard it.
Mm-hmm.
So it makes it even, you know, you can connect the two. It's a nice connection between the two, past and present.
Also, it's potential that she could have listened to that song or been given that song by Kevin as well. So the scene that we see in flashback when they're in the trailer with and her dad comes and confronts them, her hair is dark. It's not bleached. So it gives you the idea that it's maybe a couple of years before the plane crash. They're making mixtapes for each other, and really, really potential that they could have seen it, could have listened to it together. Maybe that song makes her think of him. And then, you know, this is scene that we're seeing with her grown up, where she's sort of grieving the loss of him, but also, you know, of course, all of her deep trauma that she's got as well. It's pretty intense, isn't it? It's so personal. It's a really intimate scene to be involved in watching, because it is such a personal scene for her.
Yep. How about your next point, Anwen?
So I'm going to go back into Ty and Shauna. So we touched on a little bit there with the sleepwalking that you mentioned about Ty's concerns about that. I really love all of the scenes between Ty and Shauna in this, and it really shows us how their relationship deepened back in the past and how it's still there, even if they have been mostly out of touch for the last 20 years, that it's still there. They still care for each other. In the woods, you see Shauna comforting Ty. When she's come back from her expedition, and she's so upset and feels so guilty and remorseful about what happened to Van. And so Shauna and Ty's roles have flipped a little. So Ty was taking care of her previously and comforting Shauna about her pregnancy. And now you see Shauna in that caring role, and you can see them both learning to rely on each other in the woods, and that really solidified their relationship there. We see them in the present, and then there's this awkward moment when Shauna goes, "What a surprise after 20 years, even though they've been gallivanting about with guns and ransom money all night. But, and it's just even more funny looking back when you know that that was actually Jeff right. that they were running after. So it's just this really cute sort of awkward moment. And the scene when they're lying on Kelly's bed and having a heart to heart, and they're telling secrets like they're teenagers again, it was so moving. And Shauna tells Ty about Adam, and I love that line. He's so earnest in a way that makes you want to punch his face.
Only Shauna could say that, right?
Totally. And it's so sweet. You know, it's friendships that are like that last can still have that closeness years later, even with big gaps. And I've experienced that myself. And it was really lovely to watch. I thought it was really interesting in that scene where Ty sort of lists the achievements that she's made. So they each telling their fantasy about what would have happened if they hadn't had that plane crash. And Shauna talks all about going to meet Francois in France, and he's a mime and all that stuff, which was quite funny, a little light relief. And then Ty lists her achievements, and they're all things that she actually did, like an amazing, incredible list for anybody, let alone someone who's been through that level of trauma. But she says not a single one of those things felt real. And I get the impression that she lived this really full, high achieving, busy life to make those memories go away. That's her way of coping. You know, in real life, I do also know some people who can't sit still because they don't want to be with their thoughts or emotions. So they just keep busy all day. And I feel like that's what she did. That's her way of coping with that trauma of what they went through. I think the other two that we see react really differently. So Shauna just goes cold and sort of blanks things out. She's living this kind of half life, this kind of numb life. And Natalie numbs herself with drugs and alcohol. So you've got these three women. I mean, Misty's a whole other story. She's just totally fine. She's doing her thing. But those three women are dealing with this past trauma in three really different ways. But I think three really common ways. I think those are probably the three most common ways. Numb yourself just internally, numb yourself with external devices, or just keep really busy so you don't even have to think about it. So I thought that was a really good, subtle way of showing that was the way that Ty coped with everything.
Do you think Ty was trying to achieve to make up for things she had done?
Possibly too. That's it. It's like, look at me. I can be good. I can be a pillar of society. I can lead people. I can achieve and be a good person, because all of the things that she's doing, you know, are there to prove that she's a good person. So I think you're right. Absolutely. It's trying to make up for it.
I had some notes about that. I thought Shauna just reeks of unfulfilled destiny. She lists all the things she wanted to do but didn't. But Ty did those things, and both of them seem to be in the same stagnant place. Not like in life achievement ways, but in emotionally, in, you know, evolvement of your soul, I guess.
Well, Natalie said in the last episode, she told them, you're just as fucked up as I am.
Yeah, they're all stagnant.
I think Thaisa did everything she could do to make up, like you said, to make up for it, but also to make herself so busy she wasn't focusing on anything. Shauna, I feel like, is bitter about the past that she was supposed to have. Don't think she runs around saying I'm bitter about it, but I think inside she's really angry that she didn't get to do the things she was supposed to do. And she's resentful, I think, of people who did. And it's really, you know, it's disappointing for her. I can't imagine having that tragedy and then feeling like you have your whole life worked out. And then this happens to derail you completely.
I think it's probably fairly common whether or not you've been a cannibal in the woods for 19 months or just a normal person. I think a lot of women might get to their mid to late 40s and go, okay, what's happened with my life? Is it what I wanted? Is it different? What could it have been like? And not always in a bad way. Just I think there is a bit of a reckoning, especially I think if she's going through that transition of her kids about to leave home and, you know, it's she's evaluating things. And of course, she's always going to have this absolute fork in the road in her life that happened with what happened in the woods. Could that have changed her path? Might she have done something similar anyway? Might she have just ended up with Jeff and got married and things would have been the same? Who knows? But she's obviously thinking about it.
Well, she also has the reunion coming up. And I think anytime you have a reunion like that, 10, 20 years, you do reevaluate yourself and think, oh gosh, I'm going back to this. What was I supposed to do? Was I supposed, you know, am I doing the things I wanted to do? Am I as successful as I wanted to be? Because you're going back to present yourself. And even Jeff gives her this dress, the ugly yellow dress that doesn't suit her at all. It made me at the time wonder, do you even know your wife? Because she would never wear something like this. It's super flashy. And we all know Shauna can look great. She doesn't have to wear an ugly yellow dress to do that. And this is, I think, the one final ridiculous thing we get before we start to realize that he's not the bad guy that we've thought he was this entire time. And I love what Shauna said to him. If this is an anniversary present, you are 3 months and my entire personality off. And you could see he was trying.
Maybe he's just always been bad at gifts. You know, that could just be part of Jeff's personality too.
I mean, I would say if Brian, if my relationship was measured by Brian being able to pick me out an outfit, it would be really bad. It would be really bad.
Well, I think, you know, I wondered at the time, too, if Jeff was just thinking about, well, you know, you're prom royalty, so you're connected to prom royalty, so you need to look a certain way. If that was about him, more about him and less about her, I'm not really sure.
It's funny how cringy he seemed when we thought he was having it. It's funny how things can taint how you see somebody.
Yeah.
Because I thought that scene was totally cringy. And seeing it on the rewatch, I felt like he would be just like my husband attempting to pick me out an outfit. And I thought the last thing he said was, I know you're going to turn heads no matter what you wear. And I thought that was really sweet.
Yeah.
So cute.
Yeah. All right. Daphne, your next point.
Okay. So I feel like we have to continue on the Shauna train because in this episode, I feel like Callie plants the seeds of doubt.
I have that exact same thing written.
Yeah. She plants the seeds of doubt in Shauna's head about who Adam is and what his intentions are. And we all know what happens to Adam. And I feel like this is pushing Shauna even further into that zone where she's going to try to protect herself, even though I don't know that we don't know for sure if Adam was good or if Adam had another motive that we don't know about. We may not have an answer to that question for a few seasons. However,
it sounds like you're saying it's all Callie's fault.
Well, her daughter is an interesting case because if you think about it, Callie and Shauna do not have the best relationship. At times when you think they're going to bond, it's fake. It's what Callie wants you to believe. And then Shauna comes back and is like, shuts her down, which that's one of my favorite scenes from this whole season. It's when Shauna reasserts control of the situation and steps to the top and basically lets Callie know, you are not dealing with someone who has no clue what to do. You're dealing with someone who's super smart and can take care of the situation. So don't have a preconceived notion that I'm just your dumb mom. Because that's not the case at all. I don't know what Callie's motives were, if she really cares about her mother, or if it's because she wants the family to stay together. Because Shauna certainly scared her to death about what life would be like if they didn't stay together.
I think she does care, but I think she cares in that entitled teenage,
yeah,
I'm almost an adult way.
Yeah.
And almost a little bit of, duh, mom, how could you not know all this tech stuff and how to look somebody up? You know, it's almost like I'm so cool, I'm a teenager and I know everything about internet stalking. Mm-hmm. So it's a little bit of one-upmanship as well.
Well, she was so great on the phone when she calls, I think it was Pratt, and says, this is Sandra Norberg from the UConn MFA Studio Arts Program. She's so good.
And she's making it up on the fly.
Yes. And I know we talk about how funny Misty is at times. Melanie Lynskey slays it as Shauna and brings these things. I mean, her delivery is fantastic.
Absolutely. And then when she can tell, that moment she can tell they buy her story, there's this cute little look on her face like, okay.
Yeah. They bought it. Cool. Did it again. This is great. One thing, though, I want to point out is I know last week they were talking about how old is Adam. Well, I did the math. If he graduated in 2004 from high school, then he would have been born about in 1986, which would make him about 35-ish, give or take. So he's a little bit older than I initially thought, but it's not out of the realm of possibility that a 35-year-old would find someone in their 40s attractive.
Not at all.
Hell no.
So, yeah.
No.
Especially, I think, you know, we might see later what happens, but I think you see the books or the magazines or whatever it was about the crashed flight in his drawer when she's in his place, and whether or not he met her, found out who she was, and then looked into it, and that sort of fed his desire or his obsession a little bit, or whether he knew about it before and orchestrated that. I find it hard to believe that I think you guys have covered this before, but on previous episodes, but I do find it hard to believe that he completely orchestrated it, because he was down a side road. She was driving and then turned and then crashed into him. It seemed at the time, it did seem like, I rewatched it, it seemed really pretty random. It wasn't like he was purposefully trying to, you know, and if he was, it's a pretty big guess to think that she was going to smash into him.
How long would you hang out on the side of the road waiting for her to come?
Yeah.
There's no guarantee she's going to smash into you.
No, exactly. It would have been much more suspicious if he'd rear-ended her to go, oh, look, this is an enforced interaction or encounter. So my personal thoughts are on it is that it started by chance, but then it just intensified because he found out who she was and he was a bit obsessed with that. Concept.
I don't know. Like, I think if everything he's saying is the truth, besides obviously going to Pratt, I think there's a lot of coincidence there. You know, meeting up at the hotel.
I think he was following her.
I think he was stalking her by that stage, but he would have had enough time. It was a few days that had passed between her getting the car sorted and them meeting. So I think he might have gone,
right.
Ooh,
this and is why who doesn't, this person is. Why doesn't he have a website if he's an artist?
Yeah, I don't know. That doesn't make sense.
I'm still suspicious of the situation, but I don't know.
Well, someone reported him missing, so he has friends. Mm-hmm.
Right. But he seemed sincere, and he seemed very believable. Like, in the scene where she questions him about art school, I believed him.
Yeah. Me too. Yeah. But I think what Callie started with planting those doubts, and then Shauna finding the glitter in the closet, and then thinking that he stole her journals,
mm-hmm.
It all points to Adam being the blackmailer. And so, as we see at the end of the episode, she goes there to confront him, and I'm thinking, now that we know what happens, you can look back at how this started, like how she got on this road to not trusting Adam.
And why? So let's talk about that. Why were the journals gone then? I mean, they were there before and now they're gone. I mean, again, a huge series of coincidences had to happen for that all to line up in the way that it did.
Well, and Jeff has read the journals.
Right, so is he just periodically taking them out? Because you wouldn't think he would do that.
Yeah.
Yeah, so who took them out, Jeff or Adam? What do you think?
I just don't know. I think there's more to it that we don't know.
Yeah.
But I know, like, we've talked ad nauseum about Shauna and Jackie and Shauna's motivations and Shauna killing Adam. And I will say, in this episode, I paid a lot of attention to that on the rewatch. And she sees the glitter. She remembers Adam was in the closet. And then she opens that safe and it's empty. And then she truly has an attack. Like, she's having a panic attack.
Mm.
And I think she's in she has worked herself up into this frenzied state of feeling like everything is crumbling. You know, this is the guy that I thought liked me for me and not for being a yellow jacket. This is the guy that I thought, you know, was my thing that didn't have anything to do with my marriage or my daughter or my past, you know, and now he's gonna be the guy that crumbles my whole life. I mean, this is what she's been fighting to protect for 25 years and staying out of the limelight and not giving interviews and being quiet and being fearful for 25 years. And this is what's happening. So, of course, I'm not defending Shauna for killing someone. But you can see where she has worked herself up into this frenzied panic state of mind. And she immediately marches over to his house to confront him. And she is 100% sure that he took those journals and that he was in her closet. And that he was blackmailing them. And that he's about to crumble her whole world.
And you can see why she thinks that. Everything adds up. And then you layer that on top of her past trauma and most of the stuff that we probably still haven't even seen yet. So we don't even know all the other really bad stuff that she went through or had to go through that's informing her decision around that. And it's almost that fight or flight, that defensiveness, that she's just like a knee-jerk reaction. It has to be you, so you're a threat and you can't be here anymore.
And just finding out that he lied about art school, it just all of the, you know, had to line up, all the stars had to line up in order to make that happen, unfortunately.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So, Wendy, what's your next point?
I know we've talked a lot about Misty snorting the cocaine scene, but I could watch that scene forever. When she says, A, I will Venmo you. So, Misty, I'm not going to not pay you back. And Misty taking her pulse just reminds me so much of me. Like, I hate medication. I'm the worst patient in the world. And so that would be me. And I also get super paranoid. And so I would totally be taking my pulse and, like, testing my breathing and things like that. That just reminded me so much of something I would do. The scene between Nat and Misty is really great. Misty truly cares about Nat, and she will go to great lengths to help her. She just doesn't know how to do that in any kind of ordinary way. Her way of helping her, you know, somebody who she considers a close friend, is to plant a camera in their home and kidnap her enemies without her knowledge. Like, that's just Misty. But in her heart, I think she does that out of a place of actually caring about Natalie.
So, I think she does too. But Natalie doesn't see it at all. It's just, you are crazy. That's it. There's no sense at all of, oh, well, that wasn't very nice, but I can see you were trying to help. It's just absolutely not. You were... That's it.
And I think that's because of the experiences that they've had with Misty, because you could see Natalie wants to trust her, and then she says, I don't even know if I can trust anything you say, you know. So I, you know, there's something there, and I just enjoy every minute that Misty's on screen.
That's what I had for my next point as well, was Misty
and
Nat.
Oh, please go.
We've covered it. We've covered quite a lot of it already. I just think, like, it's an amazing scene because it's really moving, but it's really sad, but it's also really funny. Like, the execution of it is incredible. And that, like you say, that heartfelt, where it's coming from is a good place. Like, Misty thinks she's being kind. I couldn't just let you watch you do that. And that's, of course, when she gets busted. Nat says, watch me, and realizes that the camera was there. He's saving her from relapsing and just saving her by snorting the drugs herself, and she's never had coke before. It was just hilarious, busting in and just quickly lining it up and snorting it.
She was like a busy little bee.
Yeah. It's just like, quick, get this in my own nose.
And like, snorting was the only option. Like, you could have, like, just put it in the sink.
But it just made it hilarious. And it's because it's sort of, you know, adult Misty is sort of seems like she's coked up anyway, because she's so frenetic and kind of energetic. And I just think that I would absolutely love to see some bloopers of that scene. I'm sure they took many takes, because if I was Juliet Lewis, I would just be cracking up. Christina Ricci is so funny when she's coked up and taking her own heart rate. And then at the last bit, when they've, you know, yell at each other. And then she goes to storm out and she just goes, ugh, and she leaves. It was so teenager, and I just thought it was hilarious. I loved it. Absolutely loved it.
Well, I mean, yeah. Misty told her to, like, Misty gave her information about Travis's bank accounts that Natalie didn't have before that.
True.
And Misty is working with her little citizen detective group to solve this case. I mean, she's trying to solve it. You know, what happened to Travis? And as we learn later, there's a heck of a lot more going on than we imagined at first.
For sure.
All right, Daphne, your next point.
Okay, I want to talk a little bit about Natalie and Coach Ben kind of bonding. And we get the confirmation of something I suspected like a couple of episodes prior. And that is that Coach Ben is in fact gay. And Natalie talks to him. I like the way that she approaches it with him. Like, it's nonchalant. It's normal. You know, well, you're into guys, right? I like that they kind of bond over this moment. And he lets loose a little bit and talks about Paul and Paul wanting to move to the city, wanting him to move to the city to be with him. But in the end, he didn't want to go because then if he lost Paul, he was losing everything because Paul would be his whole world if they moved to the city. And I like, you know, they have these candid discussions about Travis's body function issues that he's having. And it was just a really, I think, touching moment where I feel like Coach Ben found someone out there that he could talk to. Because he is there with all of these teenagers. And Natalie, even though she's a teenager, because of all the trauma she's been through, I feel like sometimes she's older than she is.
Mm-hmm. She seems to be the most mature of them all, even Ben.
Yes, absolutely.
And I think you have to look at that conversation, too, with the perspective of time. We three of us remember what it was like in the 90s, and sometimes it doesn't feel like very long ago, but sometimes it does. But it's sort of like that conversation or that revelation about him being gay would just, amongst most circles now, just not even be a thing. Whereas mm-hmm. in the 90s, it probably still really was a thing. And you don't know his family background, but like he says about not wanting to go to the city and live with his boyfriend, maybe if he did that and came out, he might lose his family. He might lose all his friends.
Yeah.
So
he might lose his job.
Yeah, it's exactly. Mm-hmm. So it's a much higher risk situation to be in than it would be now, I think.
Yep.
And so it's easy for us to go, oh yeah, that's cool. And it's pretty casually spoken about, but just remembering what things were like in the 80s and 90s, very different situation for sure. Yeah.
And it seems very much to be a secret. Like, it's not something he's talked about. So because he's a bit surprised that she's figured it out.
He was really kind of put off that he was seen. You know?
Yeah.
He thought he had that buttoned up pretty tightly.
Yeah, and he should have just looked at their boobs now and again just for editing.
Yeah. Yeah. And only women know about that because men don't. Like, they don't know what that's like.
Nope.
They don't pick up that little eye judder that happens when the eyes just zoom down a foot and then zoom back up and then zoom down. Yeah. They don't notice it. They don't notice themselves doing it.
Nope. They don't realize. So, yeah, that stood out to me in this episode.
I like them together. They're really sweet.
Wendy, it's your turn.
All right. Later, this is just continuing on with Natalie. Later, Natalie has a meltdown where she can't access Travis's bank accounts. But then she finds some cocaine on the floor. Are we all assuming that she did that cocaine?
Oh, yeah.
Okay.
I think she did.
Because then she seems a little bit more put together in the next scene. And so I thought, like, fueled by some cocaine and feeding her habit, She gets back on track and continues her mission to access Travis's bank accounts. And she blackmails her sponsor, which is really horrifying. Like, it seems obvious that she just doesn't care. Or maybe she cares, but it's not a deterrent for her. Mm-hmm. Who she hurts, who gets in the way of her path to finding out what happened with Travis. She's really destructive to Kevin and to her sponsor. I can't remember her name, but Suze. To her sponsor.
Her name is Suze.
Yeah. And she's really on this mission and she's not going to let anything get in her way. And it makes me sad for her.
Yeah. Absolutely. She's been through a lot. Young Natalie and adult Natalie. I mean, if you think about, she'd already been through a lot by the time she was a teenager. And you can imagine everything that's happened in between then and now. It's been incredibly traumatic for her. She's had a lot to deal with, and no wonder she turned to substance abuse to deal with that.
That was happening before, even before the crash. So yeah. She already had all this awful thing that happened with her father, her upbringing in general, but then the way her father died. She was carrying all that already before the plane crash, and the other girls, whatever their family backgrounds and things, they each had their own issues, but I just don't think anyone had that same level of awfulness that she had to deal with.
And her sponsor says that she hasn't seen her in 10 years. I mean, it seems like this has been a lifelong struggle with addiction that she's had. And she even talks, I think, at the rehab about also having just made poor choices in general with addiction and sex. And I think it's what we talked about earlier, that she's just stagnant. She just hasn't moved forward in anything.
That conversation with Suze also gave us a little more insight into Natalie and Travis and the promises they made to each other and why she's not able to just accept that it was self-inflicted. Because she knew him probably better than anyone else, and he promised and she promised not to kill themselves. So she takes that very seriously, and she's going to do, like you said, she's on a mission to do whatever she can because she doesn't know any other way. She's held on to this. This is part of her reason for living has been Travis. And to think that he broke that promise to her, I feel like that's why we see her at the end of this season in the depths of despair that she's in. Because she doesn't feel she has anything left to count on.
And I think she says that her promises didn't mean anything, but that his did. And so I think that the one thing she felt she could count on in life was him.
Yeah.
And now that's gone. And so she, you know, what does she have left? And that's why I think we find her right on the verge of suicide. At the end of the series, at the end of the season. And I think if they hadn't have busted in on her, she probably would have went through with it.
Yeah.
Yeah, for sure.
I agree.
Yeah.
Well, whatever they went through out in the wilderness, Travis understood her because it happened to him too. And I think not only did they bond, you know, as teenagers, you know, a guy and a girl, they bonded on their shared mutual experience. And I think that made them even closer and probably made them even more toxic to each other as well, because some crap went down that we don't know about that we will find out about going forward.
Lots more crap to come.
Yes.
All right. Anwen, your next point?
That's most of my points, but I did just want to do a quick summary of one of the things I thought was really amazing and made this episode so awesome and so dense was it was just an episode of discoveries. It was bookended beautifully. The first shot in the episode is flame, so it's a flaming torch, and then it moves to Ty's face when she's dealing with the aftermath of the attack on Van. And then the last shot of the episode is the fireball of the plane and then the group reacting to it. So it's bookended really nicely by this symbol of flame that's been present throughout.
I didn't think about that, but you're absolutely right.
Yeah, and it's a theme throughout the whole series, right? Sort of sun and flame and, yeah, explosions and things. So anyway, the discoveries that happen, I'll just quickly sum them up. There's four main discoveries in the teenage group with the teenage versions of the girls, and then there's four with the adults. So in the 90s, Ty and the other girls realize that Van isn't dead. Everyone finds out Shauna is pregnant, thanks to Jackie. Natalie confirms that Coach Ben is gay. And Travis finds out that Natalie had sex with his tormentor, Bobby, what's his face. There are four quite big reveals that some of them we knew about, some we didn't, but it's been confirmed for the characters. And then in the present day, Natalie finds out that Misty's been spying on her. Ty realizes that she's the woman in the tree. Jessica realizes Misty is actually dangerous. And Shauna finds out that Adam isn't what he seems. So it's just constant. You know, within a less than an hour episode, you've got these huge revelations mm-hmm. that are happening. And it sort of, they come on quite fast. So it was one of those episodes where you don't want it to end, but then it ends and you feel like it's only been half an hour long because it's just so fast paced. Yes. I really loved that. And I think it's perfect for this stage in the episode. So we've got two more left, right? So this is a perfect next to last one to really ramp up that tension.
I have a question for both of you. When you watched it the first time, did you expect the plane to explode or crash?
I did.
No.
I think I did.
I did.
I certainly didn't think she was gonna get away. And
no, I thought it would be too easy. At first, I thought she might crash on the other side. Like, she might get a little ways and crash.
Yeah. The fire surprised me.
Yeah.
Yeah. I've seen way too many of these movies to ever think that it's going to be successful, especially because we know we were there. They were out there a lot longer.
Exactly. So I knew that that wasn't going to lead to rescue, but I did not expect. I just thought she was going to go and they were just never going to hear from her again. And maybe we wouldn't have even seen what had happened to her, or we might see a crash or whatever off camera to them. But for it to happen in front of their faces, you know. But isn't that what they say about like 90% of plane crashes happen within 2 minutes of takeoff or something?
Mm-hmm.
Even planes that actually work. The fact that it took off at all was incredible, but that was shocking. That was one of those moments where you just cover your face with your hands and you're like, oh my gosh.
Yeah. And they did such a great job with the visceral reactions of the kids and, you know, so you can really feel it in them.
Yeah.
Any other notes, Daphne?
So we have not talked about, although Unwin just talked about Jackie.
We haven't.
This is the episode where we see Jackie has no fucks to give because she's read those journals. And now she realizes that what she thought her life was about, it's not. Jeff cheated with her best friend, who she loves, and I feel like looks at her like she's a sister. She's got nothing left. I mean, and she reveals, or makes Shauna reveal to the group, that she's pregnant. And she inadvertently, I put that in quotations, tells Travis about Natalie sleeping with Bobby Farley.
Yeah,
that's an interesting one, isn't it? Because when I first saw it, I thought, that's typical Jackie. She goes through life not noticing people's feelings or the impact of what she's saying. She just blurts out stuff, whatever. But knowing, like what you say, you know, behold her field of fucks, for it is barren. Mm-hmm. She does not care anymore. is she doing that on purpose? Does she go, okay, I've seen Travis and Nat. I think she's a bit trashy. I don't really care. So how can I stir this up? How can I make this even worse for them? Oh, I know what, I'll just casually tell Travis about Bobby. I'm really on the fence about whether that was intentional or not. Yeah. 'Cause either way works with her character.
Yeah.
I don't think it was intentional, but I think that says something about Jackie's character that she would unintentionally trash a friend. But I just go back and forth between Camp Jackie and Camp Shauna. And I did feel a lot of sympathy for Jackie here. Like, when she's talking to Shauna, I kind of thought, Shauna kind of deserves that. You know, she was sleeping with her best friend and she's still lying to her about it.
Yeah.
She's only admitting that she's pregnant because, you know, it's going to get out, you know. She knows people are going to find out. And she's still lying. She doesn't come clean. She doesn't tell her the truth. She makes up this random story about Randy. And so, yeah, I do feel sympathy with Jackie and can only imagine that she is really bitter about everything. I mean, and not only just to find that, but, you know, here I am at the end of the world, starving to death in the wilderness. Like, what do I have to be reasonable about anymore? But I do also think that the way she trashed Natalie so casually without really thinking about the consequences was really terrible to listen to. And I do think that says something about Jackie's character. And would she have casually said those things if that hadn't happened to her about finding out about Shauna? She probably would have, I think.
You think she still would have said it?
I think this is just, that's just kind of part of her personality. I think Jackie's always surprised to find out that her words have hurt people and that her actions have hurt people. She's always kind of puzzled about that later.
Yeah, because she's been built up so much by her parents to be an absolute pinnacle of achievement and beauty and perfection that she can't imagine that she would have a negative impact. Because she, again, when he walks away, she kind of looks puzzled, like, what? That's kind of weird. Why is he so upset? Yeah, it's part of her. It's part of her nature,
right? Well, because even if she didn't know the significance of it being Bobby, she knew Natalie and Travis had a thing going on, and that saying stuff like this could have an effect. I mean,
absolutely, and it's not the first time she has basically called Natalie a whore.
Yeah.
Yeah,
and I mean, so, we know what happens in the next episode between her and Travis. Right. So it just seems a little devious. She's not winning any friends with this.
No.
I wonder if there's a little part as well where, so she's down there at the lake and she sees him and he's got his shirt off and she's maybe already planting the seed for herself of, well, you know, Shauna took my boyfriend, so I'm just going to take Natalie's. Or,
I believe that.
How dare Shauna lose her virginity first? I need to catch up. You know, I think there's a premeditated part of her there that is buttering Travis up. She said the wrong thing to him, but it's her being oblivious. But I think she's already thought, right, this is what I'm going to do next. And, you know, the opportunity presents itself, obviously, at the party in the next episode, which I can't wait to hear you guys talk about. But, yeah, so I think good. It's
I But think I it's did feel like her barbs to Shauna were deserved.
Yeah. When they were cleaning the plane, when they were moving things, and she said, well, Shauna, people need to know, like, this is a situation. And I thought that was valid.
But it's valid, but it's not the truth. The truth is she outed Shauna because Shauna did terrible things to her. And I thought that was kind of deserved. And Shauna is still not coming clean, even though Shauna is pretty sure at this point that Jackie knows. Shauna's still not having that sober conversation of, you know, you just need to come clean at that point. And she still doesn't do that. She only does that when she's absolutely pinned to the, you know, to the wall.
Well, this takes me back to, if you think about, Jeff read all of Shauna's diaries. So imagine the pain, whatever happens to Shauna's baby.
Mm-hmm.
Jeff has read about it.
Mm-hmm.
And now at least can relate.
And that's Jeff's baby, too.
And that's Jeff's baby.
Mm-hmm.
And Shauna didn't know that. I mean, she probably assumed whatever she told Jeff is what he knew. But now we know that he read those journals. That I think connects him and Shauna a bit more now, because
yeah,
he may not have been there, but now he knows that Shauna was pregnant with his child and what happened to the baby.
Yeah, because I get the feeling, it's too early to know, but I get the feeling that, you know, something happens to the baby out there. Maybe he didn't even know when they got back. Maybe nobody spoke of it. And so he never knew until he read the journals, which is so huge, isn't it?
I think that's going to be a plot point at some point. I think that.
And it's probably freeing for Shauna to know that somebody knows the worst of you and they still love you. Yeah. After everything she's been through, it's probably very liberating for her to finally have someone that you can share everything with.
And knows all your
secrets. And they're still
going to
love you.
Yeah. Everybody needs a Jeff.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
We didn't think that the first time through. We did not think that.
That's how this show is so clever. Just the perspective of your preconceptions color everything that you see. It's so masterful. I love it.
It really is masterful.
I only have one more.
Okay.
And I feel like we have to talk about this just for a second. In learning that there is something in this world that Misty fucking Quigley cares about. And that is her bird, Caligula. Because she tries to play it off, well, go ahead, it doesn't mean anything to me. But as soon as she lets that go, Misty goes fully nuclear about it. And then, she's sobbing. My baby, my poor little boy, I didn't mean a word of it. Because she's devastated. You know, the bird heard what she was saying. Oh, go ahead and do it. That's one thing she cares about, I think, in this world, is that bird. It means a lot to her.
Yeah, that was my final point too, actually, Misty and Jessica in that scene. And I think there was so much else to deal with in this episode that's the only reason that scene hasn't come up, because the other points came a little bit more to the front for us. But that was an incredible scene. And, you know, I mentioned it in my revelations section about Jessica really finding out how dangerous Misty is. And I think up until now, Jessica has, you know, she's been in this situation before. She's really world weary. She seems fairly relaxed up until that point. And I think she thinks she's got it. She got Caligula and it's going to work. And then when it doesn't, and Misty just starts throwing stuff at her and she loses the bird, and then she's like, oh crap, it's really all on now. The music was so tense in that scene. I don't know if you noticed, but they had these really high-pitched kind of sustained strings, which ramps up the tension, and then this plunky low kind of cello being plucked. And that adds to that tension, and Jessica finally looks like she's actually scared. And that's when I realized, oh, this really probably is a murder basement. Like, we kind of had joked about it before, but I'm like, oh, this is not going to end well at all.
Yeah. And she really did look scared. Like, she did a great job with that. And that's probably the first time we've really seen her look scared. Yeah, that was good.
Yeah, that is all I have. We have talked about everything else.
Anything else, Anwen?
No, that's all my points. I think we've covered
it. Okay. All right, we'll take a break, and there's more to come. Please stay with us. All right, welcome back. Next, we have Anwen is going to tell us about news from Yellow Jackets.
All right. So this week from Variety.com, the Peabody Awards Board of Jurors announced this year's nominees for entertainment, documentaries, news, podcast, radio, children and youth, and public service and arts. A total of 60 nominees were revealed as an array of stories that poignantly and powerfully help us make sense of the challenges we face as a nation and world, according to Jeffrey Jones, the executive director. Yellow Jackets has been nominated in the entertainment category, so that's pretty awesome. And in other awards news from goldderby.com, with positive acclaim from both critics and audiences, Yellow Jackets might just be the series that Showtime needs to get back into the Emmy conversation. Showtime has landed multiple acting nominations in recent years, but the network has struggled to break through in the main series category. The last time that Showtime had a presence in Best Drama Series was 6 years ago with season 5 of Homeland. According to the latest Gold Derby Emmy odds, Yellow Jackets is in a comfortable fifth place for a drama series nomination for an Emmy, behind previous winner Succession, the red-hot Squid Game, and perennial nominees Ozark and Better Call Saul. The series would be following in the footsteps of other women-led dramas to earn major recognition from the TV Academy, including The Crown, The Handmaid's Tale, Killing Eve, and Pose. But the show that it most resembles is Orange is the New Black, nominated here in 2015, which similarly tells a story of a group of women haunted by their past. Luckily, Yellow Jackets will not face the same category confusion problems that plagued Orange in its early days, allowing it to cleanly contend as a drama series. And if it does get nominated, that would make Yellow Jackets the third Showtime drama to claim a spot in Best Drama Series. And considering that the field has now opened up to 8 nomination slots, it's a pretty good chance. So I hope we're going to see it. The show's coming off a big win for star Melanie Lynskey at the Critics' Choice Awards, where it was also nominated for Best Drama Series. Melanie Lynskey is expected to land her first Emmy nomination, with Juliette Lewis, Christina Ricci, and Tawny Cypress rounding out the show's adult cast as other contenders. So exciting to watch this space to see what awards we're going to see. There's another article here from Deadline.com. And this was quite cool. It had a little video with it that I recommend that you watch. It's about 16 minutes long. And it looks like a panel at some kind of convention or show or something where they had the creators of the show interviewed along with Melanie Lynskey and Tawny Cypress. And they talk a bit about the two different time threads in the story, which is really interesting. The co-creator, Ashley Lyle, says that Yellow Jackets is a universal tale of flawed women, and their goal was to take the high concept that would suck people in and then use it to disguise our story about fucked up women. And as a grown-up survivor, Shauna, Melanie Lynskey says, "We've only just seen the beginning of her characters unraveling. I love that I'm playing someone who is on the surface an ordinary housewife and then goes in so many directions. There's still so much further to go. I feel like the first strand of wool has been pulled out on Shauna, and there's so much more to do." Tawny Cypress said, "I read it and I saw the horror elements in the pilot episode. I'm such a horror fan, I just thought, God, it would be such a dream to do something like this. Not only to represent Jersey, that's where she's from, and also the trauma of the characters, she was just so fleshed out. The horror elements on top of it was too much to bear, and it was a dream come true to get the role." So I highly recommend going over to Deadline.com and having a look at that wee interview. It's really cool.
Awesome.
Thank you so much. That is great. All right, we have listener responses. Anwen, do you want to take the first one?
Sure. So Steve Barr has sent us a really cool picture of a plane with all of the different parts
really
of it.
I know, it's really cool.
And it has a little picture where there's a fuel cap, the connector, where the carburetor is and the fuel strainer and where everything sits in a small plane like that. So Steve says, "With regard to the plane catching on fire, from diagrams of similar planes, it's plausible wiring ran under the seats and cracked fuel lines leaked fuel from the wings to the seat or under the seats as well. The age of the plane, the action of bugs, mice and plants makes it possible that a fire could have started under the seat and flames reached a fuel line. I'm in the camp that the show has supernatural elements, but the plane explosion is explainable." That's really cool. That's so interesting. Because that was one of the biggest kind of points, wasn't it? That people were saying there's no way that could have happened. It seems unrealistic that just under the plane, under the seat, that would happen. But that really explains how plausible it would be.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I love that our listeners are quick to send in responses and thoughts on things, especially when it explains the unexplainable, because then it just kind of quiets the naysayers that are out there saying, oh, this can't happen. Well, Steve just explained how it can happen.
We've gotten so much feedback for a rewatch. This is really incredible. Like, it's yeah. really cool. People are awesome. Just loving this show.
They are. I'm glad.
How long till season two?
I know.
Daphne, you want to go next?
All right. Des Combs says, hey, guys, listening to your most recent Yellow Table discussion on No Compass. The topic of Jessica's exit from Misty fucking Quigley's murder basement was brought up. This reminded me of a question from my first watch. What if Jessica decided not to smoke? Would Misty have chased her down? Was this a Saw-style test? If Jess had decided to quit smoking, would Misty have seen this as growth and let her live?
I think Misty probably had a backup plan B, a backup plan C.
All the way to Z.
Uh-huh. I don't think there was any way Jessica was getting out of there alive.
No.
But I see the point. Like,
yeah.
And I think Misty has also been an observer of human nature. And so she kind of knew what was going to happen.
Yeah. And I also think that you can't think that you have Misty figured out. Because as soon as you do, she'll do something that throws you completely off. So I'm just kind of along for the ride with whatever Misty does. She's going to take us down a real strange road. And I'm there for the ride.
Next is from Jason Kabasi. He writes, we've wondered about the details behind Natalie and Travis's mutual agreement not to kill themselves. In this episode, I think I understood it a little better. When Natalie was talking to her banker friend slash ex-sponsor, she said that when she was on the brink, Travis made her promise she'd never kill herself. And then she made him promise the same in return. So apparently this happened when Natalie was seriously considering killing herself. To her, I think it was almost like Travis was saying, we're making an agreement that as long as I don't kill myself, then you can't kill yourself. So then, when he died, she thought, no, he wouldn't kill himself because that would mean he doesn't care anymore whether I kill myself. And I don't believe that. So then later, when she finally seemed to accept that he did kill himself, that's when she loses the will to live herself. I agree with that.
Yeah, that's kind of what we talked about earlier in the episode.
Yeah, I think either way, it's reason enough. So either he did it, and so therefore it releases her from her vow, or he didn't do it, but she no longer has to uphold that vow to him anymore because he's not around. So either way kind of works, doesn't
yeah.
it?
Yeah. Yep.
All right. Louis Bond says, I'm not religious, so I'm surprised how much I love the character of Laura Lee. I gasp every time her head hits the bottom of that pool. I'm with you, Louis, for sure. That religious camp was surreal. I noticed on this watch that she asked God for a sign, and a little bird fluttered down to Laura Lee on the porch, looked at her, and flew away. Those sweet moments helped me through the brutal parts of the show. Ugh, I said parts, and now I can't unsee Shauna's chicken baby. I don't think anything supernatural happened in the plane, though they tried to imply the fire started in the teddy bear. I'm sure the fuel line was rodent nibbled and rotted out. Fire probably sprang up in multiple spots. Laura Lee's faith went from mocked to respected by the girls, and she made such an impact on Lottie. Unless we're being totally misdirected, Lottie will be a major force next season. My vote for actress to play adult Lottie is Olivia Mann. Perfect look, right age, killer actress. I can't wait. Thanks, Louie. That's awesome.
All right. So Jason from San Diego sent us the following. On rewatch, this episode had a few hints that, along with the perspective from watching the entirety of the series, has me rethinking some known details. And he's given us five to think about. One, are we sure that Adam was just a guy? The first time Shauna goes to his loft as he lets her in, he does a knowing glance out the entryway as she enters. Then the second time she knocks on his door and says, who the fuck are you? His response is a deep exhale that my wife said was a sure sign of a guilty man. All right. Number two, why does Shauna say they haven't seen each other in 20 years when Ty shows up at the house? Was that lie just for Jeff? Seems like they've been in semi-regular contact, meeting at the diner, met at Nat's hotel, and multiple phone calls. That is true. I don't know why they had to keep it that secret at that point. Number three, in the scene following Jeff gifting Shauna the yellow dress and her remarks about it not matching her personality, she is wearing a bright yellow sweater. Maybe as a man, I'm missing something. Is shade of yellow or style? Huh. I think it might be the style.
I think so.
Yeah.
We didn't see it on. I would have liked to have seen it on.
You can't always tell from what it looks like on the hanger.
Yeah.
Yeah. Number four, my vote for undercover funniest line in the whole series rivaling There Is No Book Club or There's No Book Club is when Jackie outs Shauna's pregnancy and there's an audible gasp from the room, Akilah exclaims, "You're having sex?"
Yeah.
Yeah, like it's so unbelievable. It was the same when Jackie reacted too, wasn't it? It's so unbelievable that that could be happening. I mean, that's so mean. Poor Shauna.
I know. That's not
fair. And unrealistic. They're seniors in high school.
Yeah.
And she's gorgeous.
So, number five, small detail I hadn't seen in previous viewings that could explain the spontaneous explosion of the plane. During the plane cleaning runway scene, Misty can be seen moving quickly away from the engine area of the plane. I always figured the fire was started because of a fuel leak from an old cracked fuel line that could have run somewhere under the plane, and that would explain why the smoke and then the fire appears to start in the seat the bear sat on. If Misty got a hold of the Cessna manual that Laura Lee read to learn how to operate the plane, couldn't she have learned where the fuel lines were and sabotaged the flight? After all, they did show us Misty destroying the flight transponder.
Oh my God, I never thought of that.
I never thought of it, and now I can't think of anything else.
Jason, that's amazing. I have to go back and watch that scene and check out Misty and see if she's doing it. I can totally believe it of her.
Jason from San Diego has been sending in some really great thoughts and theories. So I'm glad that he sent that one in because that was not on my radar. And now I'm with you on when I need to go rewatch
that's
it.
That's really cool.
His final line is, keep up the great work.
Oh my God, I just had another thought. Is that why Misty went with Ty?
Are you thinking, is that why Misty went with Ty to sabotage that?
Yeah, I wonder why, is that why she went on the expedition? Suddenly she realized, oh, we might be rescued. I have to stop this. Is that why she, because I wondered that when she first came out of the cabin, oh, I have to go with you.
Our listeners are so smart that they've already figured out that it's the fuel line.
Amazing.
I love it. Thanks to everyone who sent us in written feedback. I believe we have some calls.
All right. Our first call is from downtown Steve Brown.
Steve.
Hello, House Podcastica. This is Steve, and this is Flight of the Bumblebee. With three episodes left. Man, we have flown through this. Previously on, I totally forgot that Jackie, when she says, when Shauna tells her that Randy's the father, she kind of does this neck thing and she goes, Randy? And oh, that gruesome Van's face. Oh.
See, whose idea was it to burn Van's, they thought, corpse?
This one time at Bible camp, at least Shauna acknowledges that what she's doing is kind of crappy. Respect it. Knowing what's actually going on with Jeff, it is kind of sweet that he bought the dress, but at the same time, I guess I should have suspected he was the blackmailer. Natalie is not taking this Kevin breakup very well. Dumped by Miss D. Quigley. God, how intuitive young Natalie was about the coach. I remember this with the cocaine. Oh, Jackie, I think you just told Travis a little more than he should have known. Don't breathe that. Don't breathe that. Hilarious scene between Misty and Natalie with the cocaine. I've got the subtitles on, and I don't think I've ever seen Kevin spelled that way, K-E-V-Y-N. And I have a friend who spells his name K-E-V-O-N. It's the first we've heard the dog is missing. I think so. How bad can it get, Thaisa? Like falling asleep and letting your friends get attacked by wolves? Or is there something more? Isn't that interesting that Thaisa felt more real out in the woods than here in her life? How it's gone since. Natalie, really, floor cocaine? That's a pretty easy way to fix that situation, Misty. Just throw things at her until she lets the bird go. Oh, her turn to just show up where he lives. Shauna showing up at Adam's place, I mean. I remember watching this the first time, and Laura Lee's, "What are you going to do to stop me, coach?" Yeah. There are so many things that go into the suspension of disbelief about this airplane and it being able to take off that it doesn't even matter that it blows up. Yeah, I see it now. That yellow dress is just horrific. Let's see. That's it. Talk to you later.
I love a good live Steve. It's the best.
Yes, that's always great. All right, our next call is from our co-host, Penny.
Hello, citizen detectives. This is Penny, and I just wanted to call in with my vote for fucked up moment of the week. This episode sure had a lot to choose from, but I'm going to have to give it up to almost burning Van alive. Talk to you soon.
And our last call is from Archmaester Rennie. And I'm just loving your feedback, Rennie. Love hearing how much you're loving this show.
Yeah. So I don't want to hold this show to an unreasonable standard of realism. Sure, maybe a fuel line broke under the passenger seat in the airplane and set it on fire, no problem. But there's one thing that I have difficulty with because of a particular book that I read years and years ago. The book is called Road Song by a writer named Natalie Kuss, K-U-S-Z. Her family left Los Angeles and went to live on the land in Alaska when she was a little girl. And she got bitten in the face by a sled dog, an Alaskan husky. And for the next many, many years, she had to battle off the infection from that bite. She actually lost her eye and part of a cheekbone. And she had skin grafts and bone grafts, which sometimes just sloughed off because the infection recurred. So with that in my memory from that book, I have trouble believing that Van's wolf-bitten face would heal so cleanly with no infection. One other thing I wanted to mention in this episode, I loved the paralleled scenes with Thaisa and Shauna taking care of each other, really Shauna taking care of Thaisa, about Thaisa's sleepwalking. And in the present day, when Thaisa and Shauna are talking to each other when they're in bed, Shauna tells the story of everything she did not get to do, and Thaisa tells the story of everything that she did get to do, just as she'd planned. So one of them got to do everything she planned, the other nothing, but both are still hollowed out by their experience, which just shows how devastating the experience was. Okay, on to the next one.
Thank you, Rennie. That is great. And yes, I think we covered that as well.
Yeah, we did.
I agree with the medical aspects of it. I read the book that Aaron Ralston wrote. I think it's called 127 Hours. He amputated his own arm out in, I think it was Utah, out in the Utah while rock climbing. And he had to undergo months and months of IV antibiotics and persistent infections, and was very ill for a long time. So when I look at the coach who had his leg amputated and just seems to be doing pretty well, it's pretty, but you know, those are the things that we have to put in the department of suspension of disbelief.
Absolutely.
I wondered too, because I mean, like we talked about earlier, we could see Van's teeth through her cheek. And to me, mm-hmm. it didn't even look like there was enough skin to sew together.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah.
Oh, it's horrendous.
Let's just put it over here. Suspension of disbelief. It's okay. We'll let it slide.
All right. That's our show. And thank you for listening, everyone. What is going on with you, Daphne? You have Run for Your Lives going. You're starting your next season.
We are tomorrow. So our first episode, we are discussing Ready or Not, which is a fun little movie. that every time I think about it, I just think of the song they play when they're playing hide and seek, and it just makes me laugh because it's a scary movie, but there are these humorous elements to it, and it's a lot of fun. So that's why we picked it to start our fourth season doing Run for Your Lives.
That's amazing.
So yeah,
that is great.
Very excited.
I am going to be doing Ozark with Strange Indeed starting the end of this month. And we are just going to, we're going to do a recap episode. And then we're going to do the last seven episodes of the whole series. So I'm really looking forward to that. I think I've binged like a season and a half because I had started it and then just kind of got busy with other things. And then I binged like the last season and a half in the last 6 months. So I'm really excited. It's so good. Are either of you watching Ozark?
I am not, but it's on my list.
Yeah.
It's absolutely on my list. I love Jason Bateman. I listen to his Smartless podcast. And I'm really keen to see Ozark. So
he's so good in this.
Might have to jump on that and listen to you guys.
Yeah. Well, it's just, 35 hours of TV.
Oh, no.
Next weekend.
Too much. It is a long weekend. I'll have to see how I go.
Yeah.
So if you want to write in or leave us a message, you can find all our contact information at podcastica.com.
And while you're there, be sure to check out our other shows. As Wendy said, Strange Indeed is coming back with Ozark, and then, of course, covering their flagship show, Stranger Things,
in May,
which is exciting.
Yes.
The Walking Dead cast just wrapped up the middle third of the last season of Walking Dead, but I'm sure they'll be coming back with a bunch of other stuff in between as well. And the next episode of this show is Yellow Jackets Season 1, Episode 9, Doom Coming. And that's going to be hosted by Daphne, Jason, and Alex.
I can't wait to listen.
I can't wait to do it, because that is one episode. Out of all of the season, that is the one episode that I wish I'd been able to be on. And so I'm excited to be able to talk about it.
When I was rewatching 8 for this podcast, I just let it continue and watch 9 again as well. It's so good. How could you not?
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, I can't wait to hear you guys. That'll be great. All right, that's our show.
Thanks for listening.
Buzz, 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 buzz.